around here. Anyway, thanks for chilling with me. You've been tuned into Morning Glory.
That was Morning Glory on 95BFM.
Thanks to the Tuning Fork. BFM News.
Ahia Humaria, good afternoon. Ko Joel Toku Ingoa, ko te Tekoma Ruakaraka, it's 12 o'clock. Half of the properties severely damaged due to Cyclone Gabrielle have now been bought out or are close to being bought out. Of the 167 properties across Hastings and Napier in Category 3 and are available for buyout, 85 properties have already received or approved property owners, with 24 already being settled. 86% of eligible properties have completed valuations or have had valuations commissioned from independent buyers. Councils expect most offers will be completed by October. The US government has tasked its space agency, NASA, with establishing a standard time zone for the moon. The time zone will be known as Coordinated Lunar Time, otherwise known as CLT. In a memo, the US Office of Science and Technology Policy said we need a reliable lunar time Earth syncing system for space missions because lower gravity on the moon causes time to move slightly faster than that on Earth. And officials in China's Guangdong province have issued a once-in-a-century flood warning as major rivers, waterways and water reservoirs are threatening to overflow. The region has experienced several days of heavy rain and strong winds. Local weather officials are calling the situation grim, saying that Xinjiang and Beijing river basins are hitting record water levels. The Guangdong province, which has a population of 127 million, is now at risk of severe flooding. More than 20,000 people have been evacuated from affected areas already. Ara te kau pūrongo, and that's the news.
A 95BFM weather update.
Anena tohu ho warere, mō tēnei rā, your weather report for today. Cloud and a few morning showers, clearing to mostly sunny, with fresh to strong southwesterly winds. A high of 20 degrees awaits you today, with an overnight low of 11 degrees. Sunrise this morning was at 8 minutes to 7, and sunset this evening will be at 13 minutes to 6. Anena tohu ho warere, mō te apopo, your weather forecast for tomorrow, Rātu Tuesday. Fine and partly cloudy, then chance of a later shower with light winds. And that's your news and weather. Ko Joel Toku Ingoa. The time is now 2 minutes past 12.
Thanks, Joel.
Thank you.
That was a 95BFM weather update. Thanks to climate change.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire. Mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Ezra. Whai Akine coming up on the show. For our regular catch-up with the ACT Party, I speak to MP Simon Court about pet bonds and no-cause evictions. I also speak to PhD candidate in the Department of Psychology at the University of Otago, Jai Whelan, about calls to increase the accessibility of drug-checking services across the country. Ezra, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Senior Lecturer of Law at the University of Auckland, Dinlana Saffel, about the proposed Restoring Citizenship, Removed by Citizenship, Western Samoa Act 1982 Bill, and the implication of the Te Tiriti-based consultation, constitutional transformation on Māori and Pacific Tau-Iwi relations.
He aha o whakaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or Waia Mai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka oe I wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kororo ano hi pakihiri roki roki maoranga I te pai tuku tuku o irarangi poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM ira kati com, and you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on our website 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The Coalition Government has made changes to the Residential Tenancies Act, including allowing landlords to charge an additional bond of up to 2 weeks' rent on top of the standard four-week bond if a tenant wishes to have a pet on the property. No-cause evictions have also been reinstated, allowing landlords to evict their tenants without providing a reason, provided they give them 90 days' notice. For our weekly interview with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about these changes. Here is that interview. Why do you believe that it's necessary to allow landlords to charge an additional bond of up to 2 weeks' rent, which you're calling pet bonds?
Well, it does provide another opportunity for families with pets to get into a home if they're renting. There are some real challenges for people with pets, whether they're dogs or cats or hamsters, to get into a rental property, because landlords can't be confident that if the pet does a little bit of damage, they can recover the cost for that. So providing an upfront mechanism where renters can say, I've got a pet, the landlord who can say, that's okay, we'll just require you to pay another 2 weeks' bond to cover any potential damages a pet might do. We think it's going to be really helpful, and particularly to women in situations where their families are separating or they arrive at a refuge and they have pets, and their biggest worry is, where will we go with our family pets? So we think this is going to be really helpful.
Wait, why women specifically?
Well, when families separate, often it's the mums who take the kids and have the responsibility to look after the pets. And what we've heard anecdotally is that this policy change, which allows for pet bonds, will make it much easier for them to be rehomed, to find permanent rental properties.
What would you believe is the average cost of pet damage to a property in a year?
I have no idea. I'm a civil engineer. I could tell you what it might cost to fix a concrete manhole. But what I do know is that if tenants are causing fair wear and tear, then the bond won't be called on. This is only for more extraordinary damage that is beyond fair wear and tear.
Landlords can still refuse to take on tenants with pets, even if the tenants have met reasonable grounds to do so. So why not then make it compulsory for a landlord to take on a tenant with a pet under this policy, at least if a tenant has met reasonable grounds to have a pet on the property?
Well, one thing just about the ACT Party is that we don't compel people to do things, and we certainly wouldn't be compelling people, private property owners, to take on tenants, for example. So we just think this is another way to relax the restrictions and to provide opportunities for people to freely engage in contracting together, willing seller, willing buyer, willing renter, willing landlord. We don't think compulsion is necessary. We certainly think it's important that for lots of families who have pets and who are renting, that this will give them more options to get into a rental property that's sustainable, that's in the place they want to live, that's near schools, that's near work.
The Coalition Government has also recently announced 90-day no-cause evictions, and you've removed an amendment that laid out some justifiable reasons for eviction, such as antisocial behaviour or consistently paying their rent late. Why do you believe it is necessary for landlords to be able to evict their tenants within 90 days without providing a specific reason?
Well, previously, under the rules that the Labor government introduced, the requirement to end a tenancy, to terminate a contract, required multiple complaints about antisocial behaviour to the tenancy tribunal, and in many cases, neighbours and other people on the property were very reluctant to complain because it meant they'd be identified and they were concerned about the blowback. These rules, which required multiple examples of antisocial behaviour to be notified, meant that a lot of mum and dad landlords, people with one or two rental properties, they just didn't want to enter the rental market and have to face this this concern. If they had a bad tenant, how on earth were they going to get rid of them? They didn't feel confident that they could follow the process. And as a result, a lot of these properties, and particularly in places like Queenstown, where there's a huge shortage of rental property for workers, simply didn't come onto the market as rentals. They were held back and used for Airbnb and Bookabatch, for example. So these changes mean that it's going to be much easier for people with one or two rental properties, what we call the mum and dad landlords, to get back into the rental property market. We believe it's going to lead to an increased supply of properties and a downward pressure in the long term over rents.
How about in the inverse? Does the government have any plans to introduce policy to protect tenants who have made multiple complaints against their landlord and have to also go through that lengthy process with the tenancy tribunal if their living conditions are not adequate?
Well, we have a whole lot of standards that have been brought in, such as the Healthy Home Standards, which landlords, people renting out properties to tenants are required to follow. And so I would expect that if a tenant identifies that a home is not up to scratch and they follow the process, then an action will be taken to notify the landlord and to require them to make good on their obligations. This government is not doing anything to take away the responsibility of landlords to provide healthy homes for tenants. We think it's really, really important. If there's going to be a willing tenant, willing landlord contract, that the landlord provides their end of the bargain as well, which is a warm, dry, healthy home.
What would you say are unjustifiable reasons for evicting a tenant within that 90-day period?
Well, the test isn't whether there's a justification or not. The test is, does the landlord own the property? Do they want to do something else with it? And therefore, what is a reasonable notice period for them to let the tenant know? And we believe that 90 days is quite reasonable. In 90 days' time, the landlord will need the property back to do something else with it. And we think that's entirely reasonable.
I suppose some people might struggle to understand if they are meeting their obligations as a tenant, they've done everything right, but then they get evicted and they're not given a reason why. Do you think that this is fair?
Well, I think what is fair is that we increase the supply of rental properties into the market. There is quite a bit of anecdotal evidence that a whole lot of properties are being withheld. They're being held back for Airbnb or simply allowed to remain empty because landlords are fearful of contracting with tenants under the current rules. So while if somebody was to receive notice from a landlord that the landlord's going to need the property back and the landlord's not required to provide, you know, a whole list of reasons why, I think the important thing is that the tenants know there will be a ready supply of rental properties that they need at an affordable price. And we think the policy changes we're making are going to bring more supply into the market and mean that tenants have more choice. So no doubt, you know, it's very disruptive to have to move your home, your family, and so on. But if there's more supply in the market, then the disruption should be minimal, and hopefully in the long run prices will stabilise and settle down.
And when would you expect this might happen for there to be more affordable rental homes in the market by under this policy?
Well, this is just one policy of many that this government is introducing to make homes more affordable in the long run. We have to reform the Resource Management Act. Currently, it's very expensive and complex to build large volumes of affordable homes, whether they're in greenfields, in other words, new areas, new subdivisions, or building up in the city. Some of that is partly to do with planning restrictions. A lot of it is to do with the cost of providing infrastructure and the very restrictive rules and limited opportunities that councils and central government have to access long-term funds. For example, you know, engaging in private public partnerships, to get money from the private sector or big institutions like ACC or Superfund or our KiwiSavers to invest in infrastructure that might have a 50 or 100-year lifetime. If we can get deals done like that, we'll be able to build subdivisions more affordably and therefore we'll have more affordable homes in time. Changes to the rental market, changes to planning laws, changes to infrastructure funding and financing, changes to the Building Act to allow building materials from comparable OECD countries to be used here as of right. All of these things are going to have an effect. It's going to be a few years before we see it land, but our aspiration is that for the people studying at university now and going out into the workplace, around about the same time that I did, around about the age of 30, they should be able to think about getting into their own home, and they should see it as affordable and possible and worth saving for and worth sticking around in New Zealand for. So that's our objective. It's going to take a little while.
That was ACT MP Simon Court on pet bonds and no-cause evictions.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Thank you. close to getting their heartbreak. Me, I'm close to killing in broad day. Little homie, you had dark days. I have no OGs. I ran a hard way, yeah. Call it how it is. Don't tell me, go tell her how it is. My team energy run far away. Come here, I wanna show me how it is. She want me, go show her how I live. Let's go. Tell her, give me sensations. Then give me redemption. Came out the train station. Spot them like Dalmatians. Pray for they need lessons. I don't even need blessings. I got the fiends itching. I got to keep them guessing. I don't be pretending. She don't need protection. When I enter the world, slip folks, now C-section. I don't seek the message, but why I keep getting them? Bring my reef, I get wavy till I refresh them. It's a situation. You ain't got bitter patience. Firing the medication. I got no hesitation. Way, way different to my guap, cause he's slim waisted. I've been sliding to the top since I was in braces. These brothers close to getting a heartbreak. Me, I'm close to killing in broad day. Lil homie, you had dark days. I had no OG. I ran the hard way. Call it how it is. Don't tell me, don't tell her how it is. My team energy run far away. Come here, I'm gonna show you how it is. She want me, go show her how I live. It is what it is. Call her what you can in. Time is of the essence, tying up the questions. Riders of the bed, where the ties, let me stretch them. Don't read the articles no more, see how they try press them. Used to walk in the kitchen, ask mama, why are you stressing? We ain't answer to companies when they try collecting. I'm built for the action, I don't need light clashing. I run on pedestrians, I'm real life Franklin. All of them fled, run. Thought they'd respond to us by now, but not once. Must be lacking funds. All I see bad junkies hiding behind guns. I still ain't satisfied when the job gets done. Call it how it is. Don't tell me, don't tell it.
Sound boy, won't you go home to your nana, go home to your nana, you're too young to play that sound, yeah.
Let 95BFM take the wheel of your weekend with Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside with Princess Chelsea and Marlon Streaming. Friday, 26 April from 4 to 7 p.m.
Cruise on down to the Beer Spot. Grab yourself a 95BFM lager available on tap and enjoy the royally good tunes of Princess Chelsea and Marlon Streaming with Friday's Drive host Anika.
Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside, Friday, 26th of April from 4 to 7 p.m. See you there.
R.I.P. Mittens. She's gone. At least I have these photos to remember her. Look, her first steps.
Aww.
Eating her first bird.
Ew.
And her last moment. I call this one raspberry jelly.
Ugh, why? What?
Damn that car.
What is that shining in the gutter?
Her beautiful angelic eye.
Pro Gear Photographic. For photos that'll bring out the light in your eyes, no matter the circumstance. Head to Pro Gear for all your photography needs. Open now at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or go to progear.co.nz.
Oh, hey, hey.
G'day, haven't seen you around for ages. What have you been up to?
Yeah, just been real bogged down thinking about space.
Oh, like planets and black holes and stuff?
Yeah, quasars, asteroids, really all the space stuff.
Oh, yeah, so that's your new job now? Like at the observatory?
Nah, just been thinking about it. It's taken me ages, though. It's big ass.
Okay.
Spaced out. Josh Aldaki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday, only on 95BFM Drive.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. A University of Otago study assessing the harm reduction behaviours of people who consume MDMA and the use of reagent testing and Know Your Stuff's drug checking service found most MDMA consumers engage in harm reduction practices relatively frequently. I spoke to lead author of the study, PhD candidate in the Department of Psychology at the University of Otago, Jai Whelan, about why it is important for drug checking services to be accessible in Aotearoa. And I started off that interview by asking Whelan about what harms MDMA can cause and how to prevent it.
Generally speaking, there's a couple of acute, more minor harms that can come from consumption, such as tight jaw, fatigue, you might find yourself getting hot, those kinds of things, or dehydrated. They can be prevented by, you know, listening to your body, making sure you're not overdoing it, make sure you're not overexercising, taking breaks, and drinking the right amount of water. Not nothing, and not too much either. If you take way too much MDMA, things can get a little bit more serious, and they may require medical intervention, but that's not often the case because people are pretty reasonable about how much they take.
Based on the findings of your study and other evidence, what impact have drug checking services had in Aotearoa, specifically when it comes to reducing harm that can be caused by MDMA?
Generally speaking, people's education seems to have gone way up. So from my study and others, people that are going to a drug checking service report learning about either the drugs and harm reduction themselves, which is great. And one of the major things that's a benefit of drug checking is getting in the door, not only to find out what you've got, but having that conversation with somebody who is trained in drug harm reduction and being able to have that conversation face-to-face with a trusted individual and really just hit home about the things that people can and should be doing to stay safe if they do decide to use drugs. And of course, having the drug checking aspect there is crucial as well, as we see fluctuations in the drug market. And that's something that my study showed as well. A lot of people that reported harm from a substance that they initially thought was MDMA, but later believed it to be otherwise. And that's something that can be essentially wiped out if everyone was to go along to drug checking clinics to make sure they know what they have.
Yeah, and like you said, harm is more often caused when someone is taking something that they don't know that they're actually taking, or if it's a higher dose, for example. So how often are we actually seeing that happening at drug checking services around the country?
Well, that's the thing, is it changes year on year. So every year when we look at the different drug reports, we see fluctuations in the different or in the types of samples that are coming through. MDMA has had periods where it's been relatively consistently MDMA, so people brought in substance that they were sold as MDMA and it has been MDMA, but then we've had really big patches, kind of 2021 summer, where there was a lot of other drugs around, particularly synthetic cathinones, and that kind of waves up and down a lot of the time, and it can be regional as well, which is another reason to get in there. You can't really trust that your drug is always going to be the same because massive changes happen country to country, region to region all of the time.
Yeah, but the main thing is that people are able to check, right? So currently, how accessible would you say drug checking is here in Aotearoa?
It's definitely gotten better. So this study was collecting data in 2021-22. And so there's been a major increase in the number of drug checking clinics provided and the people providing them. So the Needle Exchange, Drug Foundation, and Know Your Stuff are providing client-facing services up and down the country pretty regularly now and at pop-up clinics at events and festivals. However, within my study, a lot of people that hadn't used drug checking services reported that they hadn't because it was unavailable to them. There's still a lot of locations and a lot of people out there who don't have access to these services, which is why I think it still needs to be expanded. And even the services themselves, it would be great if we could expand their purview and also the technologies that they have available to them so that we can improve the quality of harm reduction that we're able to provide. One of the major limitations currently is that we're pretty unable to quantify the amount of a substance within a pressed pill, due to the nature of the testing equipment that we use and pills themselves. And it can make it really hard to provide, you know, adequate information other than be really careful if we don't know how much of a substance is actually inside a pill. That's something that we need to innovate on and be able to provide quantitative kind of information in future if we really want to take it to the next level.
And what did you find from your study when it comes to how often consumers of MDMA are engaging in drug checking behaviours or using something like reagent testing?
People are using drug checking generally, so there is a portion of people that were going to Know Your Stuff, but it seemed from my data that more people had actually had experience using the reagents, which are those liquid tests that you can buy online or in stores like Cosmic. Now, that's better than nothing. However, it can give people a false sense of security about what this substance may contain, because these tests are quite limited and they can only kind of tell you whether something is present or not in a sample. Say you have a bag which you think is MDMA and sure it has, say, 5% MDMA in it, but the rest is another drug. If you put your reagent on top of that to test for MDMA, it will still pick that up and change to the colour that MDMA changes to. So if you're using a marquee reagent, it will change to dark purple or black even. And so that might give someone the sense that, oh, they've got a complete bag of MDMA there, where it could have, you know, a whole range of different substances, but because of the colour change, they have that false sense. So although it's good to do, or can be helpful to do, if you have no other option, it still has its own problems, which is why going along to a drug checking service that has the infrared spectroscopy is a lot better, as that's a lot more accurate at telling you what is present in your sample.
What would you like to see be done to increase the accessibility of drug checking services in the country?
It would be great to just have them more dispersed. I think currently we're quite limited in some of the more isolated areas, West Coast and other rural areas, and whether that means getting mobile testing services out there or having permanent setups more regularly is something to be explored. There's also other options that could be explored further, although they have a lot of other implications associated with them or difficulties, such as, you know, mailing in substances to be checked and that sort of thing, which happens overseas. And as I said, just expanding the hours and perhaps the actual specific areas, even within cities, that those are available. Oftentimes, people have difficulties acquiring drugs and getting to the place where they can be checked, even though they plan to consume them perhaps later that day. And so perhaps extending those drug checking services later into the evenings would be of benefit as well.
Are there any barriers that you see preventing this from happening? For example, are there still any stigmas surrounding drug checking services, either them being perceived as not being confidential by the user or from people who are critical of them?
100%. I mean, there's still people out there that are critical of drug checking services, generally speaking, even though it's a pretty well-supported harm reduction service now, and we know that people are benefiting from those services. But there's also general senses of stigma, and that's something that my research also identified. Even people that are going along to those services are still worried about being seen accessing those sometimes. So that's perhaps something that we can think about evaluating, and whether we change the way we conduct drug checking services, or where those services are actually located. And people are generally worried about even being stigmatized by other people that are using those services, you know, going along for the very same reason that they are. And that just speaks to the pervasiveness of drug stigma more generally in society. And that's something that's a much bigger picture issue that we all need to be doing our best to address it and getting creative about the ways in which we do that. Another really big thing is that although this specific piece of research that I've done is related to people who use MDMA, this isn't something that should be restricted to people that use MDMA or other kind of party drugs that we think about. This is something that needs to be expanded for everyone, and it is particularly important for the people that are using drugs that are associated with greater harm and more stigma, such as methamphetamine, opioids, and benzodiazepines as well. This isn't something that's, you know, should be only for, you know, rich kids who are going to festivals all the time. This should be for everyone, and we really need to keep that in mind when we're expanding these services and prioritising work.
That was PhD candidate in the Department of Psychology at the University of Otago, Jai Willen, on their calls to increase the accessibility of drug checking services in Aotearoa.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
The world.
decolonize your mind, decolonize your eyes, decolonize between the thighs, decolonize and get wise, decolonize your ears. I could over all year, stuck your ear behind your ear, cause it's silent time and not to a year. My 30 to 23, oh, you know me, fake it for your same sea. Just a sanctuary for the Maori Pacifica, others like me. For the spellcasters, alchemy blasters, sit around masters. Pakaka and the vow of a karma, come are you and now one of us.
Taking over, taking over, taking over. All I see is the clouds of doubt.
loved me.
Hey, what did you guys do in the weekend?
I dewormed my cat.
I tried to convince my uncle that the earth is round. How about you?
I made a blood-filled horror spectacular about a cloning gone wrong in 48 hours.
Make a debatably genius movie in just one weekend. Registrations open now for the Vista Foundation 48 Hours. Get your team together and mark your calendars for the shoot weekend May 17 till 19. For more info, head to 48hours.co.nz.
This May, food trucks, live music and cozy vibes are mixed together to create three tasty nights. MOTAP's Food Truck Roundup 2024, May 2nd till the 4th, 6pm till 9pm. MOTAP and the Auckland Food Truck Collective have cooked up a cornucopia of fantastic treats and eats for the whole family. R18 for the purchase of alcohol. Under 14s must be accompanied by an adult. MOTAP's Food Truck Roundup. Free entry, May 2nd till 4th, 6pm till 9pm. Find out more at motap.nz.
Don't know a sousaphone from a sack butt? Forever confusing spittle halves for glass harmonicas? Do you get nervous around dulcimers, Hammond and Appalachian? You're not even sure which of those instruments I just made up, are you? You need travelling tunes. Let ethnomusicologist Dr. Kirsten Zemke lead you around the world on a weekly expedition of musical exploration.
Travelling Tunes every Friday on 95BFM Breakfast.
Brought to you by Drake Street Studios.
It upsets me so much that there's still people that we need to convince this is a real fucking thing. Real friggin' thing.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. A bill introduced by the Green Party's Tiano Tiono that would restore the automatic citizenship rights for Samoans affected by the Western Samoa Citizenship Act of 1982 passed its first reading in Parliament last week. The Designing Our Constitution 2024 conference also took place and touched on the potential for Tiriti-based constitutional transformation. I spoke to Senior Lecturer of Law at the University of Auckland, Dilana Safo, about the legal implications of the Restoring Citizenships Bill and how it highlighted injustices in New Zealand history. We also discussed the importance of Tiriti-based constitutional reform highlighted in the conference. Here is that interview. Can you speak on the legal implications involved in retroactively reinstating citizenships for these affected individuals?
The legal implications are simply that the 5,000 or so Samoans who were born between 1924 to 1949 will now be given New Zealand citizenship, which was denied to them through the 1982 Act. So they will be essentially be given those entitlements that all New Zealand citizens have. Which the Green Party and many other folks argue they should have had it not been for the 1982 Act, which was motivated by racist beliefs against Samoans not being entitled or not being deserving of New Zealand citizenship.
Given the historical context of this bill, how do you foresee it influencing future discussions of Pacific rights and citizenship in New Zealand?
That's a really important question. I'm really encouraged and inspired by the movement to pass this bill. I'm seeing a lot of Samoans really engaging with the political and the parliamentary process because of the injustice that was done almost 40 years ago. So it's encouraging in terms of getting our people to engage with the process. So it's influencing our rights and our societies in that positive way. I think something to also take note of, though, is how we're seeing the New Zealand National Party oppose the bill in the first reading, and the reasons that they gave for their for voting against the bill, I think, were nonsensical and disingenuous. But for us to take note that the New Zealand National Party's racist agenda against Māori is very much being transferred to Pacific causes. So we have to understand that the National Party is not a party which respects Pacific peoples and respects our rights. And even though the New Zealand Act Party and New Zealand First Party also voted in favour of the Act, I wouldn't take that as an encouraging sign or an indication of their support of Pacific peoples, because we see what this coalition is doing in a broader sense in terms of attacking the rights of Māori and their Tiriti o Waitangi, and also their wider reforms, the economic and social reforms, which will have massively detrimental impacts on Pacific peoples' rights.
Although the bill has passed its first reading, what further obstacles might it encounter during the legislative process?
So it's clear from the first reading that there is a majority, especially if the New Zealand Act and the New Zealand First Party continue to vote in favour of the bill, because it was only with their support that the first reading, that the bill was able to pass its first reading. So as long as that support is maintained, then there won't be any technical difficulties or obstacles in actually getting the bill passed into legislation. I think it's just a matter of advocates keeping up public awareness about the bill and Pacific peoples mobilising around this cause.
I've also read your recent article on a Tiriti-based constitution following the recent Designing Our Constitution conference. What specific legal mechanisms are necessary for successful Tiriti-based constitutional transformation?
Yes, constitutional transformation is a very bold but also very necessary process of realising, first and foremost, that the constitutional arrangements of the current New Zealand state are illegitimate because they violate the founding document of this country, which is Te Tiriti o Waitangi, which guaranteed Māori the right to te ora tiritanga or self-determination and sovereignty. So it's quite a transformative process that requires broad consensus amongst folks in Aotearoa New Zealand. So not just Māori, but Tauiwi or settlers. So there needs to be that consensus and that push and support from Tauiwi, including Pacific Tauiwi, to ensure that the process of constitutional transformation is understood to be necessary and important. So it's not an overnight process. It's not something that can be brought about just through legislation or through a case decision. It's a gradual process of ensuring that power and resources are redistributed to Māori in accordance with Te Roranga Tiritanga and Te Tiriti o Waitangi.
Can you speak on the importance of strengthening connections between Pacific Tauiwi and Māori in such a framework?
Yeah, so the important thing to note is that colonisation has done real harm to the connections between Pacific Tauiwi and Māori. And Moana Jackson spoke about this in terms of how Māori and Pacific were once understood to be whanaunga, understood to be indigenous peoples of the Pacific Ocean, or Te Moana Nui Akiwa, for Polynesians specifically, that we descend from the same homeland of Hawaii. But through colonization, through violent processes of genocide and also land theft and indoctrination by European powers, those connections have been obscured, where in the past any kind of relationship between indigenous peoples of the Pacific or Te Moana Nui Akiwa would have been respected, our sovereignties would have been acknowledged by all. But because of what the Crown and what colonization has done, we've been separated. There's been strains between those sacred ties. So in order for Tiriti-based constitutional transformation to come about, there needs to be that re-strengthening. There needs to be conversations, that collective remembering of those ties that have existed since before colonization, before contact with European powers. So making sure that our solidarity is linked in those sacred whakapapa or genealogical connections, which have been put under strain, but they still exist. So that's a really important step for Pacific peoples to follow, us to acknowledge that our connections, our solidarity, our loyalty is first and foremost to Māori in their struggle for Te Noranga Tiritanga, rather than the Crown and the settler government that exists in New Zealand today.
That was Senior Lecturer of Law at the University of Auckland, Dilana Safo, on the Greens Restoring Citizenship Bill and the prospect of Tiriti-based constitutional reform.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. ACT Party MP Simon Court, PhD candidate in the Department of Psychology at the University of Otago, Jai Whelan, and Senior Lecturer of Law at the University of Auckland, Dilan Asafo. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM.
just because we're running quite over time into Penny's show, but just really quickly.
Forget about Penny's show, this is so much more important, which I do admit is popular with ordinary New Zealanders who have been forgotten.
Penny's show. Penny's show.